You're listening to Wear Talk on 89.3 KPCC. In case you just tuned in, sheriff's officials in Ventura County say they have recovered a body from Lake Piru. For the past 5 days, they have been searching for Naya Rivera. She was missing, presumed drowned in Lake Piru, the former star of Glee, who was out on a boat enjoying the lake with her little boy. The son swam back onto the boat, and he is safe with family members. She has been missing, though, since over the past 5 days. A body has been removed from the lake, but there has been no official identification of the body at this point. As we do every day, we update you on the very latest of the novel coronavirus and how COVID-19 is being better understood, but so many questions about it continue. With us is Dr. Robert Kim Farley, who is professor at UCLA, professor of epidemiology and community health sciences at the Fielding School at UCLA. He was Los Angeles County Department of Public Health, head of the Division of Communicable Disease Control and Prevention for 15 years. Dr. Kim Farley, good to have you back with us on Air Talk.
Larry, it's good to be back with you.
Let's begin with the state of hospitalizations. We know that our neighboring state of Arizona is looking at almost full capacity as their surge there has proved extremely challenging. What's your understanding of where we are in hospitalizations in Southern California?
Well, in California, we've had some 6,300 people now being hospitalized currently. This is, a record high. The earlier peak back in April was 3,497. So we've had about a 50% increase statewide. So it's pushing some limits in some areas. You may have heard in Imperial County, for example, they've had to transfer patients to other institutions within the state.
Yeah, some are at Huntington Hospital, just down the street from our studios here in Pasadena. Dr. Robert Kim Farley, also, when you look at this increase in the number of positive tests, why are we not seeing an even bigger surge in hospitalization? Is it the comparative youth of those that are testing positive?
Well, Larry, that could be one of the factors involved. Also, it's still early. We could be still seeing more and more increases in hospitalizations because there is this lag between detection of cases and then when they become sick enough to actually get into the hospital. And just like there's a lag from hospitalizations to deaths as well. So we may still be on the upswing of that figure.
New Zealand appears to be the only country we've seen so far that had an outbreak of COVID-19 that now has zero active cases. They are fully reopening except to international visitors, and any New Zealanders who return home have to quarantine themselves for 14 days before they can go out in public. That's a country that locked down pretty early and has the advantage of being an island or two islands, right?
Yes, Larry, you've pointed out a couple of things. One is that they did act very quickly. They did lock down very quickly, and there was good public support for the lockdown as well as masking and other procedures. And really now they're getting the benefit of it, if you will, because they really have dropped to zero cases. And that strict ensuring that people that coming in would have to self-isolate for 14 days was also a very big factor in that island nation, as you pointed out.
Now, contrasting it with Sweden, that attempted to keep its economy going as much as it possibly could, and Sweden with a considerably higher death rate than its neighboring Scandinavian countries, in some cases up to four times the per capita death rate in Sweden. And at the same time, the economic forecast there similarly damaging as the neighboring countries that shut down. Do you feel like at this point it's definitive to you that Sweden's approach did not provide the positive results anticipated, or you think it still needs more time to determine whether their approach might have worked?
There, I think it's still going to need a bit more time. for the jury to be in the end. But I think that we are all in public health looking very closely at that Swedish model, if you will. However, as you've pointed out, early intimations now is that, you know, they have now over 5,000 deaths in Sweden. That is, you know, more than per capita than some of the other countries, 12 times more than in Norway, for example, 7 times more than in Finland. And so what we're seeing is that the procedures of not having everyone being in a lockdown or having really paid as much attention, shall we say, has paid off, unfortunately, in increased numbers of deaths. Now, in the long run, whether that still will hold, we will have to just see, because there is a couple of other things that their goalpost was not also to overload their healthcare system, and they have not done that. So they've been able to at least keep those numbers down to where the health system itself has not been overloaded.
So the deaths were more spread out, perhaps, and because one of the rationales, as I recall, from their national health director was that they wouldn't necessarily have fewer deaths over time, but that they would see a similar fatality rate without damaging the economy to the degree of neighboring countries. So I guess that's something we would need more time to determine.
Exactly right, Larry. And again, what's happened, their economy has gotten damaged because of the fact that all the other economies around are closed off and things like this. So, you know, tourism, all of these things are down, too. So that still has hurt the economy.
There's a piece by Dr. Clay Ackerley in Vox in which he describes a patient who fully recovered, apparently, from COVID-19. And then months later, 3 months after a previous infection and recovery, came down with an even worse case of COVID-19, testing positive again. And so Dr. Ackerley's says, you know, this is only a, you know, a single case. And he does see that point, that this indicates that you may not have universal creation of antibodies in someone who's recovered from the illness, and that this could be a significant obstacle to herd immunity. Your thoughts?
Yes, Larry, I think it's a good point, again, that we are going to have to be looking at very closely in public health as we begin to see some of these isolated case reports of people that have had, you know, quote, second attacks of COVID-19. It's possible, although much maybe more unlikely, that the person had a single infection that just lasted a long time. They're calling some of these types of patients the long haulers that appear to have some persistent infections and symptoms. But I think that still the research is limited. We're going to have to see, as more and more people have contracted COVID and we follow them out, as to whether any of those have, you know, confirmed antibody after infection and then get somehow a reinfection. It may also be that those persons who have very mild disease or even asymptomatic disease, the antibody levels are much lower and maybe waning faster than someone who actually had a more full-fledged version of the disease.
Dr. Ackerley in the article said this is not uncommon for coronaviruses to not confer a long-term immunity after recovery. Is that true?
Well, certainly some of these that are looking like the common cold, for example, that are coronaviruses, don't have long-lasting immunity. So from that point of view, it's true. We'll have to see whether something that does cause more severity, like COVID-19, would have that same characteristic or not.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Kim Farley of UCLA, epidemiologist and physician. He's professor at the Fielding School of Public Health. If you have questions for him about COVID-19, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Next hour, we're going to talk about whether schools are going to reopen their campuses come the fall. We've had President Trump and Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, who have urged schools to reopen their campuses. Your thoughts for a place like Southern California, where we are seeing increasing numbers of cases, do you think there are ways of at least partially reopening schools?
I think certainly all want the goal of being able to have our children back in school in an in-person environment where learning is probably much better than what we are seeing in the Zoom type of meetings. But I think that we're going to have a few things in place. Firstly, we're going to have to see that we can indeed turn around this increase that we're now seeing and be on the downslope again of cases. It would not be wise to open up while we are still in a process of increasing number of cases. So I think that that's why, again, we all need to be chipping in now, wearing our masks, practicing social distancing to make sure that we can bring the society and our communities into lower levels of transmission, community transmission going on that provides a framework for opening the schools. And then we need to make sure that our schools have the resources that are necessary, maybe staggering opening times, being able to space students out. This is going to take some money to do. So I think that we have to realize that we need to not just abandon the schools, but in fact be extra support for the schools as they go through a very critical reopening time. And it may have to be phased in different communities based upon the levels of community transmission. And we may have to be in the same situation like we've done now with bars and restaurants. We may have to dial back down should certain schools start seeing outbreaks occurring within that school.
Well, and that's happened in some countries, right, where I think Hong Kong this is happening with. I believe South Korea, if I'm not mistaken, after reopening their schools, at least had to close some campuses, then reopened again. So that would be something we saw elsewhere, too.
Yes, that's a very good point. My wife actually is from South Korea, and so that's why my last name is Kim Farley, hyphenated. We both joined our names together. So she follows it very closely, too, and we've remarked about that ability for them to discreetly, with a nuanced fashion, be able to dial back schools or open up according to the actual local community conditions.
All right. Squid GoPro writes on the AirTalk page, fewer people are presently in the hospital for COVID-19 in California than the total number of people that have died from it in California. And the percentage of COVID-19 patients in the hospital in ICU continues to drop. To what do we attribute that people who get COVID-19 appear to be getting less ill?
Yes, I think there's a number of factors. Larry, you'd even mentioned one earlier on in our discussion today about they're younger, and so younger people don't have as severe disease typically on average as someone who's much older. And I think also we've now, a few months into this pandemic, have learned some things about caring for patients and have a few drugs up our sleeve, remdesivir, for example. Dexamethasone is another one that appears to have some efficacy in severe cases. So, and even the positioning of patients, this so-called proning, where you put someone on their tummies rather than on their backs, improves oxygenation. So we're learning a lot of things that I think is also improving the outcomes.
All right. Also, blood type, finding that patients with type A blood seem to, on average, have more serious complications from COVID-19. To what could that be attributable?
It's hard to know. I'm thinking that maybe that the blood type is, again, a marker for genetic issues. And so maybe there, again, there's going to be some aspects, just like we see now with, you know, younger people who come down but have even very serious disease. We don't know what some of these factors are if they don't have any pre-existing medical conditions. There may be some genetic predispositions, and maybe blood type is just one aspect of that.
Also wanted to ask you about currently there's intravenous use of blood plasma from people who have recovered from COVID-19. And Los Angeles Times had a very interesting article about physicians saying it's really been a hole in treatment that the plasma hasn't been used by way of injection to try and protect people from COVID-19. What do you think of that?
Yes, I think it's a very interesting approach. I think a couple of things need to be looked at. Firstly, we still don't have the results in for the plasma trials that are being done in patients that are hospitalized. if we can show that plasma given to patients that are hospitalized improves their condition, that then gives some promise that this idea of plasma or antibody therapy would be effective. Once we know that, I think it would be interesting to go ahead and try, just like we do with hepatitis A, for example. We have immune globulin or rabies immune globulin that we give to people that have had, you know, bites from a rabid animal. These are basically taking these antibodies from persons who have convalesced from the disease, and they are protective usually for a short amount of time, maybe 3 months or so, but that could be effective for people that are maybe at high risk in healthcare settings, things like this. I think one problem that we're going to find is the economics of it, in the sense that since all the work is being done on promoting vaccination, if the vaccines are effective, then the idea of having a temporary protective measure from antibody, convalescent antibody being injected may not be very economically viable. We wouldn't be doing that. But perhaps there's still room for both. That we don't have to make a choice of one or the other, because certainly there will be some people, for example, who will not be able to take the vaccine because maybe contraindications for their particular situation, in which case then this idea injected antibody may be a solution. So
yeah, well, even as a bridge, even, I mean, I understand the economics of it, if there's not a long-term application, but a bridge could be very important.
I think you're right, Larry.
Thank you, Dr. Robert Kim Farley. We so appreciate your being with us again and look forward to your joining us very soon. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Robert Kim Farley, UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Elisa in Riverside says, I was in New Zealand during their lockdown. They were doing contact tracing super thorough. We had to provide information everywhere we went. We're over 70, and we weren't able to leave the house at all. That's Elisa in Riverside. Coming up, we'll talk about the state of TV and film production, as well as commercial shoots here in Los Angeles. We're back in 90 seconds on Air Talk.